Johnny Gilbert. Yeah, that's right. We have Johnny Gilbert bucks now. How likely are you to recommend this podcast to a friend or colleague? We are hope this helps, and we hope you decide. Hello.
Hello. Who is Johnny Gilbert?
He's the announcer of Jeopardy.
Oh, how did I never know his name?
I don't know.
Oh.
But now you know.
Yeah. No, I guess I'm just curious how I get these Johnny Gilbert bucks then.
The dark money comes in from somewhere. I don't know where I'm going with this. I didn't think this bit this far in, I guess.
It was a good intro until I questioned it, and then it just threw you all off.
Yeah, that's okay. Yeah, so who are we? We are Hope This Helps, and not only are we Hope This Helps, we are the 34th Hope This Helps. We are announcing show number 34, and my name is Steve.
And I'm Tiffany.
And tonight, our categories include random topics, also known as our Hope This Helps boot up. We're going to talk about DevOps versus ITIL, Microsoft, the workplace and the future, and AI and creepiness, and all kinds of fun ethical discussions. Microsoft license maps and the changing landscape, again, of Microsoft 365 licensing. Maybe a Docker container of the week if we get there. That is accurate. And ask the Stiff's question of the week. Some of these topics may or may not be discussed. We will see when we get there. If you are a returning listener, thanks for sticking with the okayest podcast on earth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you are a new listener, welcome to the show.
This is pretty consistent for us to have our second episode of the year. So hooray.
Hooray.
And I just want to say that Q1 so far, at least for me, has been insanely busy. Suddenly, like all of the stuff that everyone was holding off from last year, everyone suddenly like, let's do this all right now. And I'm like, okay, there's still a pandemic and I still have all of the stuff in my life, such as like video schooling a child, which is not fantastic, I will say.
Yeah.
So I think that there's so much that's happening now, and there's this part of the country or part of the world that like everything is going back to normal, and then there's the parts that are not going back to normal.
It's like we're going back to normal disproportionately, and is actually just making things kind of worse in a lot of ways. And yeah, that's sort of the state of everything, I guess.
Thinking. So let's spend the next hour and not think.
I'm okay with not thinking for at least an hour.
Yes. So we will likely do what we normally do and have a little bit of ADHD and go down tracks that just kind of pop into our heads at times.
Yeah, we usually do that. And that's why I specifically made the first topic a nonsensical one. Like, what kind of alcoholic beverage is each cloud service?
Ooh. I see that you have a couple here in the notes, which I absolutely agree with, Azure being tequila.
Yeah, so I put a few starter topics in there. I thought of Azure as tequila. Maybe not the greatest tequila, but just okay tequila. Like Tres Comas from Silicon Valley.
Oh, see, I was thinking like Sansa, like the Sansa gold. Not even like silver, just like gold. Mm.
That's possible.
You just put that stuff in a margarita or really whatever.
I was thinking sort of like a tequila sunrise. Mm. And it's akin to Azure. The more you drink it, the more things change around you.
That's true.
You know how Azure works. It's never the same. It's always different. Even Microsoft's tutorials can't keep up with Azure.
Right. And they have the vibrator tutorial, which I think is fantastic. I think you need to tell everyone about the class you were taking.
Yes.
I don't see it in here, but while we're on the topic of Azure being like tequila.
Absolutely. Yeah, you reminded me of that. And I had that wasn't even on my mind, but we are pulling that right in. So I took AZ204, which is Azure IoT Developer. Several of these labs have to do with simulating a cheese company where you have to put these small little IoT devices on a conveyor belt or measure a conveyor belt for speed, temperature, volume, and of course, measuring if it's vibrating too much or too little. And you have to go down the entire path of declaring IoT devices and sensors and metrics and dashboards, all having to do with vibration sensors and having it send emails to you. And currently my inbox is filled with a bunch of vibration sensor notifications from Azure, from the IoT hub.
And what was the file called?
So there were several .NET, not .NET. There were C# programs. And oh, Vibration Sensor Hub, that was the name of the program that was the main driver of this lab. And bear in mind, this is a lab that Microsoft wrote. This wasn't something that the vendor that I was taking through training wrote. This was actually a Microsoft Training Path course lab thing that you can take and gain experience points on your Microsoft account, possibly for credit towards an exam or something. I gotta say, I was just laughing my way through this lab. I guess maybe it helped me understand it a little better, but I don't know if anyone in marketing ever comes up to Microsoft and says, hey, do you know that some of this word choice could be skewed as something else?
Right.
I don't know if they have that layer at Microsoft.
And that's not the first training that we've gone through where there may have been some typo. Not even typos, but accidental arrangement of words and or letters.
I mean, at the same time, this is also the company that was trying to peddle the Zune, which had a poop brown color and the feature of squirting songs to one another. Not paraphrasing. That was the actual term that Microsoft and Steve Ballmer was recommending. Wait, during the era of the Zune in the 2000s.
How does it sound to squirt a song into another song?
You squirt your song to another Zune and you either get 3 plays or 3 days to play that song. That was the DRM. That, 3 plays or 3 days, and then the squirting disappears and you have to re-squirt.
That sounds like a constipation ad.
I mean, it is a consensual operation. It was done via proximity and Wi-Fi.
That is so true.
You know, I didn't make this up. This is all stuff Microsoft did.
Okay.
If you want to take it up with them, feel free to.
So a little living life on the edge with some squirting action.
Yeah.
The
Zune failed for a myriad of reasons, but maybe that was a contributing factor.
Right.
Some of its naming and marketing. But it lives on in the Vibration Sensor Hub in the much more successful Microsoft Azure universe.
Yes. Or Groups Exchange.
Yes, Groups Exchange. I actually fell into the trap. I was trying to tweet something with the hashtag MS Exchange, and you need to capitalize that very carefully. Otherwise, you will attract an interesting section of Twitter.
Yeah, you mean a hashtag group sex by accident.
Yes. Yeah, so I'm not sure if Microsoft actually thinks all this through or has this layer, but man, I love some of this stuff sometimes. This is hilarious.
It is pure entertainment. I mean, you might be able to get Groups Exchange with the vibration patterns.
Maybe they can squirt the data to one another to save on bandwidth.
Maybe. Oh boy.
We'll track it all in a dashboard, don't worry.
Right. We'll keep it all in one place for everybody.
And you'll be paying one hot subscription for it all.
So do we put conditional access around that?
Oh, we can. Some RBAC, some resource locks.
Is this like BDSM for tech lovers?
More or less. There are so many allegories and references that we could wrap around this to just make it all understandable in the funnest
right,
way possible.
You know, all under one umbrella.
Exactly.
It's a slippery slope. For sure.
Indeed.
All right. So we didn't actually...
We were talking about tequila, right?
Right. And then we went down this Azure road.
Oh, God.
Oh, before we move on from Azure, wasn't there just a video released about how to pronounce Azure?
There was. Microsoft, yeah, they want to know about the millions of ways people pronounce Azure. And even just today, I was listening to some podcasts earlier today when I was working out, and I think it was the Tech Meme Ride Home. Man, that Brian at Tech Meme Ride Home, dude, Azure, I don't know how you get Azure out of Azure, but that's the hill he's going to die on. He's just going to pronounce that Azure.
The hill I like to die on is, yeah, sure, and I just say it really fast.
I've heard Azure,
I know.
Azure.
I mean, yeah.
Out of all the ways you can pronounce it, it's funny just how much you can screw that up, I guess. I don't know. I've always called it Azure. I've never had a problem with the pronunciation or had some kind of
no
strange alternate universe upbringing of how to pronounce that.
it makes you almost wonder if the people who are pronouncing it are in fact drinking tequila.
That is possible. I mean, I won't be judging anyone.
No. So totally side and random thing. Speaking of drinking and like teching, I recently have gotten like super nerdy and have fallen into like the Warhammer world. And I was watching a video of someone painting while drunk, and it just reminds me of like what I'd imagine it would be like working during the day drunk. It was what it is like with me working during the day sober. Was this person drunk? And I was just like, nope, I'm pretty sure I say all of those things at least before 10 a.m.
For me, I'm like in a drunk state by default unless I have coffee, I found.
Yes.
This is something probably everyone experiences, but it's like the first 30 minutes you log in and do anything at work, remotely or physically, anything you do is probably just going to be a complete mess or make no sense, or you're going to have to like fix it in an hour or two after you've had a nice cup of coffee and actually thought about what you just did.
Yeah. And by a cup of coffee, he means a pot of coffee.
Yes, I do have my very aptly labeled 2019 Walt Disney World half gallon coffee cup that I got back before you were not allowed to go anywhere. That cup has become very cherished now to me and means a whole lot more than it ever used to just because of all that.
Right. You can think about Disney World and drink coffee.
Exactly.
Now that is the happiest place on earth.
Indeed.
All right. So I digress. Azure is definitely tequila. AWS, you had Jim Beam.
There's a question mark next to that. I kind of put it as a placeholder. I actually have almost no experience with AWS. I think you're the resident AWS expert here.
And by that, I don't have that much experience with it, but I just know that people like it a lot. And if they're stuck using Azure, they just complain a lot about Azure and how AWS is better. But I've never actually heard any reason as to why it's better.
It could be uptime and maybe just raw distribution of nodes and networks and things. And maybe just that you almost never hear about it going down, especially not nearly as much as Azure and way less than Google and iCloud, but for different reasons.
From what I understand, it's more about how much easier it is to use as a developer. But I don't really know if that's the case or if AWS is just fudging a lot of things that Azure enforces. Again,
I can definitely understand the difficulty angle. I mean, not having used AWS, but having done way too much in Azure through trainings and stuff and still trying to get my head wrapped around it, even after this long and just learning it. Azure is confusing. What compounds that problem really is the fact that Azure is always changing. There was a joke I saw somewhere where it's like, yeah, you can get certified in Azure for this month, but it's going to be useless to you in maybe 6 months, a year down the road when they change the whole interface again. And I encountered that in actually one of the training labs from Microsoft themselves when it was like, okay, make this one thing. I forget what it was exactly for the IoT hub, but the interface had completely changed. Some of the options had been completely renamed or removed. And I was just lost. I was like, I don't know what to do here because there's a different path to configuration now that just didn't exist when this guide was written.
Yeah. No, and I've noticed that as well, just in various admin portals with Microsoft, is that I'm like, yeah, I know this was just here yesterday, and I attribute Microsoft to my imposter syndrome.
Azure made me question like life as IT. Is this how it's going to be going forward? Because this is going to be rough. I hope AWS is a little bit easier than that.
I hope so. If anyone can confirm, we'd love to hear.
I've also heard that Google's cloud is kind of, so I have Bud Light next to Google Cloud. I've heard it's just kind of in a strange place where it's not quite built to really sustain the amount of load that AWS and Azure can. You know, it's Google, so you never know if they might just lose interest and stop developing it, kind of like maybe Stadia with this week's events. I don't know. It's Bud Light. It's there when you think alcohol. It's the thing you think about. Is it good? That's I guess that's up to the user.
Agreed. So speaking of the Super Bowl, what were your thoughts on it?
It was a football game. I mean, it was like Tom Brady versus a high school team from what I saw.
That's exactly what I said. I was just like, yeah.
I consumed a lot of scotch and pigs in blankets during that. 10 out of 10.
That is
would drink again.
Would drink again. Since this is a tech podcast, what did you think about the halftime show and the use of just the whole thing?
What was different this time around was they used the whole area of the field for all the stuff, and they put the stage up in the stands. I assume that probably involves a lot more drone work than probably before, and especially when they went through the closed quarters to do that little spiel. I assume that's what you're referring
yeah,
to.
Yeah, because I thought that it was really interesting how they used a lot of area, and it was just the use of technology was pretty cool. Like, I don't know the ins and outs of it because I haven't looked into it, but I'm like, wow, there has to have been a lot of coordination and lots of sensors and things everywhere. Probably some vibration sensors.
Oh, yes. Vibration sensors, temperature sensors, all of that. Yeah, the NFL usually is actually kind of a good place for maybe test driving technology. If it hasn't already been secretly used by military or government already, it's kind of like sort of a debut spot to use it in such a massive area with a lot of eyeballs. It is also one of those things where wireless gets stress tested to its absolute maximum because you have all the bodies around in a stadium and you have to make sure that's perfect. It could be something like the case for 5G. Like, I think last year, 5G sort of made its debut in the previous Super Bowl as a limited rollout for whatever that was worth.
Right.
And I know there's like 3D camera imagery where you can composite multiple cameras to create a 3D model of what's going on and all of that. That's fun. And it's quote unquote leveraged by AWS with Next Gen Stats, which is a major sponsor of the NFL, which is ironic because Microsoft Surface is the official tablet of the NFL. So you got some bumping fists with some sponsorship competition going on there between two competing parties.
Wow. That's pretty cool though. I was impressed. I didn't watch the Super Bowl because I was just, again, like, it lost its pizzazz by not really having all the buildup because I am such a fair weather, like, football fan.
It was kind of nice to have less stress to watch it without having your team in it. Being from New England, it's like you're still Tom Brady in the Super Bowl, but he's not on your team anymore. There was a map I saw broken down by state as to what state was rooting for what team. And it shows New England just as a big blob labeled as, I don't know, man, this just feels weird.
Right. It was like, this just is awkward, I guess. It's...
That perfectly encompassed my thoughts.
Same.
Other than that, I don't know. It was, I think the commercials were getting a little better. They were kind of going on a downward spiral for a couple of years, but I thought they actually improved this year. I was finding myself watching them a little more often.
Well, that's good. I watched the halftime show independently yesterday. Well, last night. I felt like I needed to at least do that so I could pretend to keep up with people in conversation.
I saw the game and then I didn't watch the very end, you know, the celebration bit, but that was on YouTube, so that was no problem. But everything else I already saw. And yeah, it was a Super Bowl. Nothing really bad or awful happened. It was just kind of a blowout game, and it happened. That's my glowing review.
That's how I feel about everything these days. It happened.
It happened.
Came, went, and conquered.
So speaking of happening, Google Cloud is Bud Light. I don't know. I was trying to rhyme happening with Heineken, but that's not happening. Mm. Heineken happening is not happening.
No. Wow. Heineken happening.
Nope. iCloud is Heineken, to conclude our alcoholic beverage cloud service discussion. iCloud is just kind of like, what are you doing, man? It's trying to be kind of like I'm a cloud service, we swear, except we don't really do a whole lot of cloud service-y things that you would think of. Other than just like we give you storage, but do you offer compute instances or networking other than just the basic consumer level? Is it remarkable or give me much of a reason to use it over anything else? Debatable, I guess.
Right. Agreed. I agree with that.
Side note, Heineken is disgusting. That's just my thoughts, my two cents on that.
Yeah, it's not great. It's just like water with some flavor.
I would say it's like worse than water. I remember having it and I was like, this tastes like battery acid. I can usually tolerate a lot of awful beers, but this was a new level of bad.
No, I agree. It's not great at all. I think I would prefer Bud Light much, much more than Heineken.
Yeah, if I had to choose, yeah, it would be Bud Light, I think, for sure.
I don't even know if I know anyone who likes Heineken.
I don't either. I remember it was the time I had it, it was in college. Someone brought it. I don't know who brought it. I don't know who liked it, but man, he can take his high knees and drink them.
His high knees. He can take his high knees and go in the corner, drink his high knees.
The corner guy.
The corner guy drinking his high knees. Anyways, so we're going to stop talking about alcohol now because we just went into like a good 30-minute discussion. But what is
so much for an intro topic.
Right. So what is this 5-minute rule? Oh, yes. Okay. I was just about to say, what is it? But I know now. I'll let you explain.
So the 5-minute rule is something I swear I kind of came up with this, but I'm sure others maybe came to the same conclusion. It's a phenomenon that you receive a message. Hey, I need your help. Can I help you with this? Do you have a second? Whatever it is, maybe it has context, maybe it doesn't. But the thing you always do is you don't reply immediately. You wait about 5 minutes minimum, maybe 10 minutes maximum, and just let it simmer, let it boil, let it marinate. Then maybe you can reply to them if they haven't already gotten back to you saying, never mind, I figured it out, I'm all set. Or if you then pry it in to their brains, they'll go, oh, you know what? I can logically figure this out. There's been some subliminal amounts of time that my brain could let it fester. And that sort of brings me into my second topic of rubber duck debugging. If you ever have a major problem, what you do is you take a rubber duck. It doesn't have to be a rubber duck, but we're going to call it the rubber duck. And you set it down in front of your computer on your keyboard. So you have to stop what you're doing. And you have to explain your entire problem to the duck, step by step. There's a strategy to this because you're talking out your problem. And you're actually working your brain in a way that you may not consciously understand, but behind the scenes, there's cogs turning, and you might actually solve your own problem. So this correlates with the 5-minute rule, and I found a little sysadmin thread that sort of validated my thoughts on this. It said, quote, I won't answer most messages I receive on purpose for about 10 minutes, and most of them reply back before I do, never mind, managed to do that, worked with this, thank you. Always happy to help.
Hope this helps.
Hope this helps. You can just be there more for emotional support if you just wait a little while before replying. And especially if it's in the morning before you've had coffee, because you're just going to make it worse if you just immediately just shoot back a reply that is like almost drunk in nature.
Agreed. In my organization, before we grew into like a larger IT org, we have a Teams channel called IT Help. Which is great when you only have like a few people, but I've actually found that it has now turned into exactly that. Hey, I need help. And then like people immediately jump in. It's almost become an echo chamber.
Yeah, we have a similar channel called Crowdsource where it's no particular topic for the channel. It's just hey, do you need a bunch of eyes on this and you need anyone just to think it out with you? Lump it over here and I don't know. It's like a forum, I guess. More brains are better than one, and distributed multi-threaded thoughts are also better than one.
Mm-hmm. No, it's so true. It is good. But I do think that in those cases, it does definitely turn into it can turn into an echo chamber of people being like, oh, I didn't think about that. Is this a process? It also can help spread bad behaviors.
Yeah, there's the concept of the confirmation bias, where the first person to answer one question skews the entire conversation in one direction, and every reply will just kind of magnetize to that, because going against the salmon rush is harder on your brain than it is just to say, no, what that guy said, as opposed to a varying opinion. There's a whole psychological element to everything in IT. Half of IT problems are not even IT problems.
Right. It's all people problems.
We're more or less just therapists that know how to type letters onto a keyboard and click things.
Agreed. I feel like to be in IT, you should have like a psychology degree or something. Half the stuff that people talk about, I'm like, I don't know if I'm qualified to tell you or to answer you. But that leaves you to the rubber duck debacle, not debacle, debugging, which is like telling your problems to a rubber duck. Someone in DevOps had told me about that about a month or two ago. And I totally forgot to tell Steve, which is my problem because normally we laugh about stuff like this. I was like, that's a really interesting concept. But then I'm like, but the duck won't talk back. I need someone to like yell at me back.
it may not work for everybody. It'll help you maybe solve some of the problems. Sometimes you need something to yell at you back. Maybe you could program the duck to kind of just yell random expletives back at you.
What I need to do is like find a small like Raspberry Pi that would fit in a duck and just like put an IoT or a chatbot in it. So when yes. I talk at it, it'll just like yell back at me.
Yes. You got the Raspberry Pi Zero duck.
Yes. Yes.
But yeah, that was all I had on the 5 minute rule.
Right.
And ducks. Psychology in IT, I guess.
Yes. Duckology.
Speaking of duckology and edges of insanity, edges going away, or at least the old edge, no more old edging, we could say.
So we're getting a bit edgy?
We're getting super edgy. The old Microsoft Edge, the original Edge, also known as Project Spartan back in the very early Windows 10 days, is going to be forcibly ripped out of any remaining Windows 10 installations it exists on, replaced with the Chromium Edge, and that is coming very soon, actually perhaps this month even. March 9th, the legacy version of Edge will no longer receive security updates. It is going to be ripped out at some point via Windows Update.
Yeah.
And the move from Trident to Chromium will be complete.
So my real question is anyone going to even notice?
To be honest, I think some people might not, because there were some folks I've talked to, some even in IT, that didn't even realize that Edge got completely reborn into the Chromium engine. And a lot of folks, I still see the old Microsoft Edge icon in their taskbar. So to be totally honest, you'd think it would be something that more folks would notice, but you'd be surprised sometimes at how much people cannot notice things.
Right. And that's what I mean, is that I'm not sure that most people even know.
The original Edge was interesting. It was to be completely built based upon a new engine within the UWP infrastructure. And it was okay. I remember it was respectable, functional. It had some extension support, but I guess it was just too much of a headache behind the scenes to have a new and unique browser engine that wasn't Chromium or Gecko or based on some of IE's old guts to continue forward with, which then resulted in Microsoft saying, okay, we can't do this anymore. We need to backtrack. What's good? Chromium's good. Let's base it on Chromium and call it a day.
Right. It just seems like such a waste. I don't know.
Competition is good. I am not thrilled that they went with Chromium to once again establish a further cemented dominance in the Chromium browser engine to eventually, I don't know, eliminate Firefox and the Gecko engine or anything else that dares challenge the now insurmountable Chromium browser market share lead that it seems to have, almost akin to like what Internet Explorer might have had in the late 90s, early 2000s. Although not quite owned by Microsoft this time, it's partially open source but heavily influenced by Google, which runs Chrome, which is by far the most dominant browser out there, with Edge in second place and then Firefox in a very distant third. And oh yeah, I guess there's also Brave and Opera and whatever else is swirling around.
So I didn't realize that Opera was still around. And it's still like the same logo from 1995.
Opera, I believe, rebased on Chromium. So it used to be its own engine, but they actually made the same shift that Microsoft did. They discarded their own engine development and they just switched to Chromium.
Right. It looks like they switched from the Presto engine to Chromium in 2013.
Yep, that sounds about right. They were one of the first ones to jump ship. Brave is a derivative of Firefox, I believe. It's supposed to be like privacy oriented, mm-hmm. but it kind of has its own interesting behind the scenes things going on, which I don't know if I'm super into.
I see.
Then you have older projects like Pale Moon and Waterfox, which were based on Firefox, but they're very niche browsers at this point.
Interesting. I just really didn't realize that Opera was still a thing.
Yeah. I mean, not many people do probably. I think like 6 people probably still use it. Safari is also Safari, but it's like WebKit, which is just weird Chromium. So it's also, I just kind of consider it to be the same in the same club.
The weirdest thing about Safari is that it's just one of those strange browsers that just kind of works enough for it to not be annoying, but it's really not a great browser.
No, it's the okayest default browser that you have on macOS that you use to download something else with.
That is the best way to explain it. The okayest browser.
Is it fast? Yeah. Does it work? Yeah. Can I install all my favorite extensions in it? Maybe, maybe not. It depends on what Apple actually let in and how stringent their extension policy is, which I've heard is not super great. And then you have all the usual interesting things Apple does with its own browsers. I do like the privacy features that's built in. Some of that stuff is really cool. But at the same time, I can replicate almost all that in Firefox anyway, so why would I bother?
Right.
Other than maybe battery life.
Right. No. I agree with that.
So, yeah. So anyways, back to Edge, though. It's going to be switching over probably within next month or so. If you're already on newer versions of Windows 10, I think it's already switched you over. I could be wrong on that. Citation needed. I guess March 9th is the final day of Classic Edge.
Oh, that's so sad. My heart is broken.
My heart is so broken for that browser I may have used one time.
That one time at Bandcamp.
That's the tech world now. Don't get too attached to anything because it just could be gone.
They'll just rip it away from you. Doesn't matter.
It could be gone in a flash, just like actual Flash.
Oh, yes. Something else to talk. Did we mention that last week? How Flash is... I think we did. We went into a long discussion about Flash. Never mind.
We had a big eulogy for Flash last episode. Yeah, we've buried it, and we're trying to decide on what the post funeral luncheon is going to be for Flash. No, we're pretty much all set with it.
Yeah, no, we're good to go. Okay, let's not keep talking about Flash then.
What do we got? Here's something that I wanted to put on the docket. Microsoft screwing with the host file, and I'm tired of it. And not only am I tired of it, other people are tired of it too.
Yeah?
Yeah. So I was experiencing a problem independently where if I was trying to build my own host file and just fill it with either ad blocking or ad tracking removal items or just customize it to my will, I was having problems where I was just fighting Defender like tooth and nail, just bare knuckle boxing it, trying to get it to stop deleting the file that had been created outright and marking it immediately as some kind of virus or malicious software. And it's apparently gotten worse. Now, if you save the host file, especially to the default host file directory, which is C, Windows, System32, drivers, etc, hosts, and add certain Microsoft hosts to it, such as the telemetry hosts, perhaps Visual Studio-based hosts or Microsoft.com, if you try to save it, you'll get an error stating that the file contains a virus or malicious information and it was reverted to its default state. Not only this, you can also make a host file yourself, and depending on what's in it, it might get scooped up by Defender as a malicious item. And that's just getting into questionable territory at best. And I know I've been just frustrated with it. There's been a couple of articles talking about it at length. I don't like it. It means you have to revert to using possibly like a hardware firewall to block these hosts if you want to. And Microsoft might claim that it's for the spirit of telemetry or enhancing the customer experience, but there is definitely a line to that. You need to respect what the user wants. And if the user wants to block these hosts, give them the full rein on this. I don't like it when an operating system gets in the way of that.
No, I agree. That's also really obnoxious.
Windows Defender detects it as a settings modifier, win32/hostfile hijack. That is the specific categorization that it puts it in. And the error that Notepad will throw at you is operation did not complete successfully because the file contains a virus or other potentially unwanted software.
Oh.
So fun. So yeah, you have to set up either a pie hole or set up router-based DNS redirection or blocking some other way. And if you're in the enterprise, obviously, maybe an ASA or pfSense or whatever you got, just set that up and use that. Don't rely on the host file or PowerShell scripts to set that up because Microsoft is watching for that.
They sure are. While we're on the topic of Microsoft complaining, I need to throw this out there. WTF is Microsoft Viva, and why did they decide to do it, announce it at the weirdest time?
Viva, so like Microsoft Life? Is that what
Have you not heard of Viva yet?
Nope. Apparently they haven't announced it loud enough for me to hear it. Microsoft Viva, what is that?
So this was just announced 6-ish days ago. It is a, for lack of better words, a dashboard that basically allows you as a person or an employee to see all of your company's stuff in one place. However, I'm like, isn't that what Yammer was supposed to do? And I'm just like, what is this product?
Isn't that what Microsoft Search and Edge?
Right.
Isn't that what that set out to do? The Microsoft 365 Search that was talked about at Ignite at length?
So my question is this just a dashboard that they just pulled together a whole bunch of stuff and they're calling this Dashboard Viva?
Yeah, it smells like dashboard in here. That's what this is.
It smells like dashboard.
Yeah, it smells like pointless dashboard in here. It smells like pane of glass, buzzword, executive telemetry speak stuff. That's what this seems to me.
Admittedly, I am working on a project that I have to do all of this anyways. So this might just save my life of having to work on like an employee experience. I'm like doing this whole like project this year on improving employee experience. I mean, this could actually be helpful for me, but at the same time, I'm like, WTF, Microsoft, WTF.
Another dashboard, great.
Another dashboard.
There's so many dashboards now. I need a dashboard for my dashboards.
Well, and that's what this feels like. And ironically, so I was working with someone last week. Basically, it's called Workspace 365. And this person accidentally like came across this and they're like, OMG, this is the best thing ever. And I'm sorry if I'm like misrepresenting this person and their excitement. But basically, they got really excited about the fact that you could have a dashboard for all of your dashboards.
Oh my God, we have reached peak dashboard.
Yes.
We have solved the world's problems.
Deploy Viva connections on your existing infrastructure. Target your content based on your Azure Active. That's assuming that you have your Azure Active Directory groups like all up to date and ready to go.
You sent a link over about Microsoft and the workplace of the future, how AI can help you build more productive relationships with your colleagues. And this smells like the productivity score kind of stuff that they were doing.
It's like they stuffed it into a different bag and they're like, here you go. We're going to find a way to give this to you.
And you're going to like it. We're going to repackage this strange, ethically questionable process that we have, but we believe in it, and we're going to make you believe in it.
Right.
Yeah, workplace analytics having to do with find time. So some of this stuff is good, right? You can use some of these AI tactics to offload some thinking work that you would normally have to do, like figure out when meetings are. But I mean, the scheduling assistant has always kind of existed as well. So I don't know if this is trampling over any existing product. It's the cloud. It's shiny. Let's give it a new name.
Right.
They want to call it the modern workplace.
Yes, that is very true.
Satya Nadella talks about reimagining the employee experience. Some of that transformation is features in Teams and Yammer. Oh, yes. When I think about reimagining everything, I think Yammer. That's my number one.
So what is very intriguing to me is that, again, I feel as if I have been on the cusp with Microsoft. And again, like I don't like Yammer at all. I'm trying. I really am trying, but I'm like also very much so struggling. But also I can't handle Teams being an echo chamber for distraction all day because I will be in it all day being distracted.
I actually have been really enamored with this feature of Edge. I think it's a glitch, but if I use the Teams web app in Edge, I actually don't get sound notifications anymore for Teams.
Oh.
It actually has been really nice because I get the notifications through Edge, but it doesn't play the sound. I don't feel like psychologically triggered now with that Teams IM noise going off every 2 seconds anymore. And I feel like I can actually manage my Teams notifications now as opposed to just getting hammered with audio cues all day. I know I could turn it off, but I kind of need it on at the same time. But Edge forced my hand to try it with them off, and I'm like, I kind of like it off.
Right. No, I agree with you 100% is that I've had to find different ways because some of the channels I just can't keep up with.
We have a channel that is dedicated to pulling all of the Microsoft 365 service alerts.
Oh, no.
Let me tell you, that is going all day. There is always some kind of incident or advisory in Microsoft 365, and it's always, always, always giving us some status update or the latest on what's down in the system.
Yeah. So that's all I'm going to talk about now for Microsoft stuff. I just really felt like we needed to get to talk about Viva before I forgot about it.
Yeah, and that's fair. And how they're doing AI things in the modern workplace. Jeff Snover of PowerShell fame is on the committee for transforming the modern workplace for whatever that means that Microsoft is trying to push. And Microsoft is also trying to push up some roses and bring dead people back. They filed a patent that can create a chatbot that would let you talk to dead people. That happened this week.
I've seen that episode of Black Mirror. I am good. Thank you, Microsoft.
I have too. The one with the mannequins.
Yeah, it's the first. The attic mannequin. The first episode of season one, and it is terrifying. It is absolutely terrifying.
So remember that time we were going to talk about MagSafe?
Yes.
Totally not sysadmin related, but Apple related and hardware related. So MagSafe is kind of back, but not in the way that you want it to be back. It's now just a weird wireless charging puck that sticks to things and can knock out pacemakers and is magnetic.
Wait, it can knock out pacemakers?
Yeah, there was an advisory put out that said, do not put an Apple iOS iPhone MagSafe charger near a pacemaker because it could interrupt it. That's not good. It's not great at all because of the magnets and the electrical wireless charging and whatever implementation Apple did with it. It's possible it exists in the standard Qi charging protocol, but they say don't get that near your chest. It's probably because it is more likely that you can hold up a MagSafe charging iPhone to your chest to use a phone in such an intimate manner that it may get in close proximity with a pacemaker, and that's not good.
Wow. Well, that kind of makes sense if you think about it. They literally put like a giant disc magnet in the back of the phone that is strong enough to like stick on dashboards and cases and stuff.
This advisory was also talking about not only the charger, but iPhone 12s as well, because they contain the MagSafe guts in them for that. Maybe not our generation, but older folks will keep a phone in like that pocket protector pocket of their flannel shirts or dress shirts on the left side, kind of near their heart. That's probably what they were thinking of.
So what about people who run with their phones on their arms? So are they saying like, don't put it on your left arm now? You have to put it on your right arm? Like if I have a pacemaker and I'm a runner.
Yeah, that might complicate things. Yeah, I guess my answer to that is I'm not a doctor and I don't know. Apple put out a KB article about this. So they said about the magnets inside iPhone 12, 12 mini, 12 Pro, 12 Pro Max, and MagSafe accessories. There's an official Apple KB article about this. And they say medical devices such as implanted pacemakers and defibrillators might contain sensors that respond to magnets and radios when in close contact. To avoid any potential interactions with these devices, keep your iPhone and MagSafe accessories a safe distance away from your device, which is more than 6 inches or 15 centimeters apart, or more than 12 inches or 30 centimeters apart if wirelessly charging. Consult with your physician and your device manufacturer for specific guidelines.
Hmm.
Your right arm, I'm just looking down. My right arm is maybe roughly 10 inches away from my heart, I guess, when it's in a standard running pose. So maybe keeping it on your right arm might keep it fairly away from your heart. I don't know about the left arm. That might be just slightly closer. So yeah, it's definitely something interesting. So yeah, Apple actually put out a real advisory about it. Not to say that
that's wow.
It's the end all be all, but it's something to think about.
Good to know. So don't get an iPhone 12 and a pacemaker at the same time.
So DevOps versus ITIL, what's going on with that? And change management things.
Okay. So this has been on my mind for some time now, for like the past couple months or so. I've been also hearing and doing a lot of reading about DevOps and how sort of they work versus ITIL and that foundation and that framework. Because it's very interesting to see both sides of the house. One side that uses the CI/CD pipelines, and then also see a break-fix department really try to find what works best that is in a very modern workplace, in a very modern technology-filled environment where DevOps is a huge priority. So it's kind of interesting to see the two having that they need to work together, because it's really hard to have an IT organization without any sort of structure, because the CI/CD pipeline doesn't really work for your break fix. Unless it does. And again, I'm still learning about it and there's things that I'm missing. But I get that ITSM in general can slow things down and it can be very gruesome. But at the same time, I feel like the DevOps, the CI/CD pipeline can also be the same way.
There was a quote in this article I liked where they say, it was able to modify ITIL to work with this new DevOps approach. Don't do everything the ITIL book says. And yet, following ITIL for practices such as incident management are, quote-unquote, still the best way to do it because everybody knows what to do and you don't get confused about the rules. But the thing about ITSM and ITIL is it has a bend-don't-break mentality, so you can adjust things to your processes. Like, don't just take it out of the box unmodified and roll with it. You can do things such as, if it's something that needs constant integration, constant deployment, CI/CD, like DevOps, you can maybe work into your model change requests that are pre-approved over time, and you can make it so that, yes, you're still following the process, but you're fast-laning it, and you're not bogged down by all the paperwork every time, and you can template it like in ServiceNow. And that's something that can maybe merge both worlds appropriately.
Right. And I think what this article does nicely, like going to say, is that it's a rock and a hard place. DevOps really wants a business to reevaluate how it's thinking and wants to organize teams into more functional, like project-led teams. So you're really focused on the operations and the getting it out into smaller teams. But as your organization grows, it's harder to do that. It's harder to have all your ops in one place and have it just like go out the door. So DevOps really works for a business that's doing a lot of development, but if it really forgets about the other departments and it doesn't create the visibility into changes and so forth that might affect other teams.
I recall in ITIL training when I took it in my ITIL foundation knowledge that is totally, totally the end all be all, that in order for ITIL and ITSM to be successful, the entire organization has to buy in. It can't just be one small department. It has to be everybody. If one team is not going to beat to the drum of ITIL, it's going to fail. So it's important to have the discipline and education of the entire org and the stakeholder confidence and enforcement and all that. Everything has to move as a unit for ITIL to work. If it doesn't, you're going to have problems.
Well, and the other part is using automation and getting a lot of things automated that would have historically needed oversight.
That too. And that's workable, I'd say. Maybe you can have it set up so that automation can be part of the process or submit some of that for you or have it, I don't know, there's probably 1,000 ways you can phrase it or set it up.
Exactly. So it's not really like a one size fit all. And something that I am seeing is that people who traditionally have been just in ITIL or who have just been in old agile scrum teams and stuff, they're really struggling with this new modern working style that does allow things to move a little bit faster. And I can even myself say that I get hung up because I come from ITIL, where I'm like, oh, we have to have a change board. But I think there's parts of me that needs to let up on that and needs to allow for more approved changes, because the goal is to not slow down the business.
There's a quote in this article also that states, Slater, DevOps is not as nearly as black and white as those zealots might have you believe. For example, the quote-unquote continuous in CI/CD doesn't mean all the time or even as fast as possible. In practice, continuous means as fast as practical given the particular business requirements that apply in this situation.
Right. So I think that's pretty cool, is that they both are fairly flexible. In ITIL 4, the goal is to be more flexible and does support more agile framework into it, because I think at some point they did realize that ITIL was too stringent and had a lot of rules that didn't really cater to development.
And at the same time, not all development is just build it, push it, and just slam it out there and fix it as it breaks.
Exactly.
It's like the startup mentality of just, who cares, just get it out there and we'll fix it while the plane is flying.
Exactly.
And ITIL is more about slowing it down and saying, no, you gotta very carefully think it out. But the speed of which ITIL operates isn't always ideal for everybody, especially not DevOps.
Right. So I think it's pretty cool. I think there will probably be more of a shift of this whatever it is, and ITIL like coming together and creating a little baby.
There will be IT DevOps, Dev IT Ops, IT System Ops, ITSM, CICD Ops. Oh, man, this is not landing well. I thought I was going to come up with something funnier than this.
Yeah, no, it didn't work out well.
They will slam together until they make something.
They sure will.
Maybe some vibration sensors.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah. Is that what DevOps does? All right. Shall we continue?
Yeah. Let's look at all this licensing.
I haven't even had a chance to dive into it yet.
M365maps.com is what we are talking about. It is a nice little site that tries to simplify all of the licensing layouts in Microsoft 365. Sort of akin to msportals.io that Adam Fowler developed, but for licensing as opposed to where all the portals are.
Right.
So that's fun. Lots of simple diagrams, Venn diagrams. I'm going to click a Venn diagram for the student use. Oh my God. It's a Jeopardy board of products. This is insanity.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, that's A5 student use. Wow, man, I need more edibles to be able to understand that graph, I feel. That's not an easy thing to consume.
No.
You know, at 10:40 at night, and the color scheme definitely hurt my eyes a little bit, and wow, that's fun. So are they changing this, or is this just more of an organization of the existing stuff out there?
So this was, an MVP made this. I actually think Aaron Dinaj might be a Microsoft employee who just does this on the side.
That's possible.
Yes, Microsoft employee. This is not like a Microsoft approved chart that he's made, but this, well, I mean, it's Microsoft approved, but it's not sponsored by them. He made this last year, but it looks like it might have been revised again.
Last updated February of 2021. So this should be very freshly updated.
Right.
Within the last 9 days. It's a good reference at the very least. We talked about this a long time in the
We did.
Maybe like a year ago, but it wasn't like this simple. It was like a bunch of links with a bunch of these diagrams.
So I guess I'm interested to see, like, for the full student use, does that mean that your licensing has to be done correctly every time?
Most likely. That yeah. sounds about right, at least to me.
Right.
Because usually A3 or A5 is the most common license type that I do see across education. I've seen a fair amount of educational applications of student licensing, and these two are usually the ones you want. If you got money, A5, otherwise A3 if you want the limited.
Exactly. No, I agree.
But that's licensing. We'll put the link in the show notes if you want to hurt your brain looking at
it. Right. Your peepers.
And it might actually be a really good resource for someone who's trying to figure this all out, or just map out what they have or what they need or what maps to what and all of that landscape.
All the fun stuff.
So can we finally talk about a topic that I've pushed off for at least 4 episodes?
Yeah,
now?
Let's do it. It's all your, this is all you.
All right. So I want to talk about a little thing that I want to make recurring every once in a while called the Docker Container of the Week. And this is generally to kind of not only raise awareness about Docker and containerization, but sort of illustrate it in a light that can show you that it's something that's approachable, and it's simple, and it's down to earth, something you could do at home, and it would introduce you to the concepts that could scale up to enterprise and make you really smart sounding at work. We're going to talk about two containers for the sake of argument and comparison that can manage your media, that is your music, your photos, and your videos in a web interface. We will talk about Plex Media Server, which is familiar outside of Docker as its own standalone product you can install on PCs, but also offers a Docker option. And then there's Jellyfin, which is the open source fork of the MB Media Server And we'll compare the two of them to talk about the benefits and the drawbacks of each and the general setup of them as well.
Fun.
Yes. So in terms of comparing the two, so spoiler alert, my choice is actually Jellyfin over Plex. My reasons for that are that Jellyfin is fully open source. Plex has had a couple of concerns in recent years, I suppose, having to do with analytics and wanting to upsell to subscription-based services, which is respectable, but not all users may want that or necessarily sign up for that kind of thing. Jellyfin, by comparison, is an open source fork of MBE, which is an entirely self-hosted solution that only reaches out to the internet for things like tagging. According to the official description, Jellyfin is a free software media system that puts you in control of managing and streaming your media. It is an alternative to the proprietary MBE and Plex to provide media from a dedicated server to end-user devices via multiple apps. Jellyfin descended from MBE 3.5.2's release and ported to the .NET Core framework to enable full cross-platform support. There are no strings attached, no premium licenses or features, and no hidden agenda, just a team that wants to build something better and work together to achieve it. So right off the bat, I'm like, right on, man, that is awesome. And setting it up in Docker, I highly recommend in Docker using the Docker Compose configuration of setting things up. What is that? It is basically a .yml or YAML file that contains all of your container's configuration. It denotes what you want to call your container, what image you want to pull from the Docker repository, all of the settings you want to configure to get it off the ground, and where you want to store your data or pull from your media libraries and existing storage to map inside the container. Remember, a container is kind of like a virtual machine, except not. There are some concepts that carry over and others that don't. And the idea of mapping storage into your container is a concept, and mapping ports is less of a concept of VMs, but more of a concept of Docker, where you take the host's available ports for the network and you can map them inside the container to what the container is expecting for a port. So for example, we have port 8096 for Jellyfin. That is what the container expects, but you can map that as whatever port you want for your host as long as it's available. So I could give it port 9999 if I want to. Just inside my Docker Compose, I'll say port 9999 is going to port 8096. And that's as simple as that. And there's also a couple of other optional ports for Jellyfin if you need to. Like if you want to do a reverse proxy to HTTPS, you can enable 8920 for Jellyfin. And there's also port 1900, which unfortunately I didn't write down what that was for. I just know it's an available option for something. I recommend Docker Compose. And so let's also compare it to Plex. Plex is very similar. The version that I have deployed on my Raspberry Pi was the linuxserver.io form of Plex. But again, Plex is not fully open source. It has increasingly gone more of a subscription-based model and has had a couple of issues. And more recently, there was a potential security vulnerability in the UDP traffic broadcasting capabilities it has, and is sort of a developing situation. As far as I understand, Jellyfin does not have this issue, or they have implemented it in such a way where it's not a problem. But between these two, you can use either one to stream your videos, photos, and audio through a myriad of devices. Plex is widely supported across many devices. You can get the app on Roku TVs, your phone. You can remote right into your Plex via a browser if you port forward or use a VPN. Bear in mind, though, Plex does wall off some features and require subscription for the app on mobile devices. Jellyfin, on the other hand, does no such thing. As long as you set it up and you have visibility to your server, which I recommend, don't just expose raw HTTP to the internet. Not the greatest idea. Put it behind a reverse proxy with SSL certificates, or just put it behind a VPN. I personally use the VPN option. I use OpenVPN to guard all of my stuff with certificate-based authentication and then standard user-based authentication. It's sort of halfway to two-factor auth, but it works well enough. Anyways, Jellyfin also has pretty good cross-platform support. Not quite as wide as Plex, but it's wide enough in my experience. You don't have a Jellyfin app on Vizio smart TVs, as far as I understand. There is a Roku variant. There are some third-party apps for iOS, for particularly the Apple TV. There is a native Jellyfin app for iOS. and Android has 1.5 million options. But other than that, that's the general Docker gist for at least media options. And I try to limit the comparisons between two containers just for the sake of simplicity. But this week's discussion is just between these two, Plex and Jellyfin. If I had to pick, I pick Jellyfin, and we'll have plenty of other container type options in the future that we'll discuss. I have a whole long list of potential ideas for future episodes and topics we can go over. But yeah, that's the Docker container of the week. Plex versus Jellyfin. The winner by a country mile is Jellyfin.
That's really, I'm going to have to check out Jellyfin now.
I like its interface. It's pretty fast and simple. Real good for just hosting media. And like the manifesto stated, it's just free open source. No subscriptions or nothing like what Plex has kind of done to itself.
Yeah, I don't know what Plex has done to itself, but it's not great.
There's been some interesting discussions on the GitHub regarding some problems with the latest version of the Plex Docker container, particularly a really nasty 100% CPU bug.
Ooh.
Some folks are claiming there's a race condition currently in the container with some kind of problem that's causing performance issues. There's also a question of whether or not there's some crypto malware style behavior going on in Plex. It's kind of unconfirmed, but I've been watching these discussions on the Linux server Plex Docker image discussion.
Ooh.
And it's not quite sure where they're stemming from. And then there was the article that came out about the major security vulnerability in Plex. That Plex apparently is kind of more or less stating it might be a configuration problem that exposes the issue, but at the same time, they're pushing out an update that will apparently protect against it more. So it's a little bit dodgy as to where the true source of the problem lies.
I've had concerns about Plex now for some time. It looks like until recently there wasn't a viable option.
I found the article. It was an Ars Technica article, but DDoSers are abusing the Plex media server to make attacks more potent using something called SSDP, and it's also leveraging misconfigured DNS servers, network time protocol. But the SSDP stands for Simple Service Discovery Protocol, which locates universal plug-and-play gateways on the modems. And a lot of folks will often just expose their Plexes to the internet, and that can just kind of be open season on your potential network if Plex is your attack vector to then get to the rest of your network and find out what's serving media. And this particular vulnerability is for DDoSs.
That makes sense. Well, and just like in general, what they've done to Plex, it's like it's gone downhill.
Right. They kind of went from a free and open source product to a kind of free, kind of open source, but maybe pay the subscription, and we're getting more to try to compete with the Netflix space world.
Right.
That kind of thing.
I also didn't realize that regular people use Docker containers to just like host stuff. And maybe I just need to get with the times.
Containers can be definitely used for something like that. I know at home I'm hosting a little Apache HTTP container that's literally hosting one HTML file that just, it contains a bunch of links that go to my other Docker container web interfaces because I'm too cheap to actually put in a dashboard or anything else like that. I just wrote my raw HTML to point to all my other stuff.
That makes sense.
But yeah, self-hosting is awesome, and it's as easy as just getting a Raspberry Pi 4B, loading it up with Docker, and just going to town. I recommend Portainer for a GUI for container management, mm-hmm. especially if you're brand new to Docker. Get Portainer installed so you have your web interface for deploying other containers. It's sort of the equivalent of like VMware vSphere or Hyper-V Manager. It just gives you a nice clickable interface, and it gives you an understanding as to how certain things work, or configuring without having to deal with a command line interface if you're not into Unix, that whole thing.
Agreed.
That is it for the Docker container of the week. We will have more to come, as I have a whole laundry list of ones that we can talk about, because I love deploying stuff to my Pi and loading down my Pi, because for some reason you can just handle all that. It's like that graphic of that boat that has all those containers and it's tilting over and sinking. That's literally my Raspberry Pi right now.
Yeah, no, that is your Raspberry Pi.
My current projects are trying to figure out Pi Hole. What was the other one? I want to figure out Caddy for a reverse proxy, so maybe I don't necessarily have to force open VPN for everything. Maybe a couple low-hanging fruit, lesser security options I can maybe offer through a reverse proxy remotely. The sky is the limit in terms of what you want to set up. There's plenty of YouTube videos and tutorials. There's one guy called DB Tech that I generally use as a starting point. There's also the self-hosted subreddit and the awesome self-hosted GitHub. Lots of resources, and you can just spend hours on these, just learning and learning and learning. And Docker is getting big. It's used as a lot of Azure IoT stuff now.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, in a training that I took that leveraged Docker, I actually taught the instructor that he was using a Hello World container from the Docker Hub. And there was actually a bug where they pushed a new image of that Hello World container, and they actually forgot to ship the AMD 64 image for it. So the lab broke because that tag was missing, and the instructor couldn't figure it out, but I actually could based on the errors. And I showed him, I said, I think Docker Hub screwed this up for you 2 hours ago when some dingus decided to forget to include the AMD 64 support for this Hello World image, which sounds kind of bad in retrospect.
That does sound really bad.
There was no Hello Worlding to be had that day.
No. Goodbye, world.
Goodbye, world.
Goodbye, world.
I was hoping I could think of that as accurate by the time we got down here, but it seems that I have not. I don't know if we have a that as accurate this
week. I don't think so. I think we've just talked a real lot. There's a lot to talk about. There's a lot of exciting stuff coming down the pipeline.
Yep. So nothing is accurate this week.
No.
We couldn't think of anything, unfortunately. And same for the question of the week. We just came up with nothing. We were just so enamored with everything else. I think we just didn't happen this week.
Right. It's okay, because you still get to hear us talk for a good amount of time.
Yeah, I'd say we have plenty of other stuff that filled the gap, so I'm no regrets there, no regrets there.
No regrets.
Okay, so are we at the end of the show? We've actually
we
talked about everything we wanted to talk about?
Yeah.
Cool. So we're, hope this helps. We are a continuous integration, continuous deployment podcast that is continually integrating and continually deploying. Most days.
Most days. Yeah, that's correct.
I think I made what's called a DevOps reference.
Yeah, there. You did. That was great. Considering there's no real framework to DevOps. No, I'm kidding. So we are a somewhat tech podcast that we tend to go off the rails and talk about other stuff. We don't have any sort of cadence in that. I'll take blame for that. But you can catch us on hthpc.com. We are on Anchor, and you can, I'm going to do the YouTube thing, like and subscribe.
Yeah, if you like us and comment and subscribe and give us a rating wherever you rate podcasts, usually Apple, but I've also heard other places do it too. If you like our podcast and think others would like our podcast, feel free to give it a shout to other people. We like listeners and feedback and all kinds of the usual podcasty things. I don't usually hear a lot about other sysadmin podcasts, so we like to sort of fill a gap that supposedly is kind of lacking.
We are the gap fillers.
We are. Oh, yeah, we have Twitters. Check out our Twitter. HTH the podcast is our official Twitter for Hope This Helps. And then we have our own individual stuff we do via the tweeters.
Yeah, the tweeters, which I'm actually currently distracted with right now because of the lock the taskbar video.
Oh, yes.
Like,
yes, instead of rock the Casbah, it's lock the taskbar.
Much needed.
It's wonderful.
It was great. Needed that today. Yes.
If you like off-brand content that I do the Things Learned podcast, which is a weekly show, 17 episodes strong, and there's actually 26 completed episodes. I just have them releasing on a weekly schedule, and I currently have it built out all the way through April to May. That's just kind of sometimes tech, sometimes not. It's overall potpourri, a nice little 30-minute podcast if you just want to hear about anything from 2011 and before. That's my secondary side gig podcast that I just do on my own time.
Yay. Good times. All right.
All right. So are we good? Are we good till next week or the next time we record?
I think so. I think we're good to go. I think I'm happy with our outcome. And till next time.
And if we're all happy, everyone's happy. We hope this helps, folks. Till then.
Thanks.
Bye.